more than double the proportions of the irreligious. Though the nuns supported Clinton over Trump by a ratio of 3-1, they stayed home on November 8, 2016, while the evangelicals lined up to vote. Similar patterns apply to populist movements in Europe. Pundits are apt to mistake this electoral clout for a comeback of religion, an illusion that gives us a second explanation, together with fecundity, for why secularization has been so stealthy. Why is the world losing its religion? There are several reasons. The communist governments of the 20th century outlawed or discouraged religion, and when they liberalized, their citizenries were slow to reacquire the taste. Some of the alienation is part of a decline in trust in all institutions from its high water mark in the 1960s. Some of it is carried by the global current toward emancipative values, Chapter 15, such as women's rights, reproductive freedom, and tolerance of homosexuality. Also, as people's lives become more secure thanks to affluence, medical care, and social insurance, they no longer pray to God to save them from ruin. Countries with stronger safety nets are less religious, holding other factors constant. But the most obvious reason may be reason itself. When people become more intellectually curious and scientifically literate, they stop believing in miracles. The most common reason that Americans give for leaving religion is a lack of belief in the teachings of religion. We have already seen that better educated countries have lower rates of belief, and across the world, atheism rides the Flynn effect. As countries get smarter, they turn away from God. Whatever the reasons, the history and geography of secularization belie the fear that in the absence of religion, societies are doomed to anomie, nihilism, and a total eclipse of all values. Secularization has proceeded in parallel with all the historical progress documented in Part 2. Many irreligious societies like Canada, Denmark, and New Zealand are among the nicest places to live in the history of our kind, with high levels of every measurable good thing in life, while many of the world's most religious societies are hellholes. American exceptionalism is instructive. The United States is more religious than its Western peers, but underperforms them in happiness and well-being, with higher rates of homicide, incarceration, abortion, sexually transmitted disease, child mortality, obesity, educational mediocrity, and premature death. The same holds true among the 50 states. The more religious the state, the more dysfunctional its citizens' lives. Cause and effect probably run in many directions. But it's plausible that in democratic countries, secularism leads to humanism, turning people away from prayer, doctrine, and ecclesiastical authority, and toward practical policies that make them and their fellows better off. However baleful theistic morality may be in the West, its influence is even more troubling in contemporary Islam. No discussion of global progress can ignore the Islamic world, which by a number of objective measures appears to be sitting out the progress enjoyed by the rest. Muslim-majority countries score poorly on measures of health, education, freedom, happiness, and democracy, holding wealth constant. All of the wars raging in 2016 took place in Muslim-majority countries or involved Islamist groups, and those groups were responsible for the vast majority of terrorist attacks. As we saw in Chapter 15, emancipative values such as gender equality, personal autonomy, and political voice are less popular in the Islamic heartland than in any other region of the world, including sub-Saharan Africa. Human rights are abysmal in many Muslim countries, which implement cruel punishments such as flogging, blinding, and amputation, not just for actual crimes, but for homosexuality, witchcraft, apostasy, and expressing liberal opinions on social media. How much of this lack of progress is the fallout of theistic morality? Certainly it cannot be attributed to Islam itself. Islamic civilization had a precocious scientific revolution, and for much of its history was more tolerant, cosmopolitan, and internally peaceful than the Christian West. Some of the regressive customs found in Muslim-majority countries, such as female genital mutilation and honor killings of unchaste sisters and daughters, are ancient African or West Asian tribal practices and are misattributed by their perpetrators to Islamic law. Some of the problems are found in other resource-cursed strongman states. Still others were exacerbated by clumsy Western interventions in the Middle East, including the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire, support of the anti-Soviet Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and the invasion of Iraq. But part of the resistance to the tide of progress can be attributed to religious belief. The problem begins with the fact that many of the precepts of Islamic doctrine, taken literally, are floridly anti-humanistic. The Quran contains scores of passages that express hatred of infidels, the reality of martyrdom, and the sacredness of armed jihad. Also endorsed are lashing for alcohol consumption, stoning for adultery and homosexuality, crucifixion for enemies of Islam, sexual slavery for pagans, and forced marriage for 9-year-old girls. Of course, many of the passages in the Bible are floridly anti-humanistic too. One needn't debate which is worse. What matters is how literally the adherents take them. Like the other Abrahamic religions, Islam has its version of rabbinical pilpul and Jesuitical disputation that allegorizes, compartmentalizes, and spin doctors the nasty bits of scripture. Islam also has its version of cultural Jews, cafeteria Catholics, and Sinos, Christians in name only. The problem is that this benign hypocrisy is far less developed in the contemporary Islamic world. Examining big data on religious affiliation from the World Values Survey, the political scientists Amy Alexander and Christian Veltzel observed that self-identifying Muslims stick out as the denomination with by far the largest percentage of strongly religious people, 82%. Even more astounding, fully 92% of all self-identifying Muslims place themselves at the two highest scores of the 10-point religiosity scale, compared with less than half of Jews, Catholics, and evangelicals. Self-identifying as a Muslim, regardless of the particular branch of Islam, seems to be almost synonymous with being strongly religious. Similar results turn up in some other surveys. A large one by the Pew Research Center found that in 32 of the 39 countries surveyed, half or more Muslims say there is only one correct way to understand the teachings of Islam, that in the countries in which the question was asked, between 50 and 93% believe that the Quran should be read literally, word by word, and that overwhelming percentages of Muslims in many countries want Islamic law, Sharia, to be the official law of the land. Correlation is not causation. But if you combine the fact that much of Islamic doctrine is anti-humanistic with the fact that many Muslims believe that Islamic doctrine is inerrant, and throw in the fact that the Muslims who carry out illiberal policies and violent acts say they are doing it because they are following those doctrines, then it becomes a stretch to say that the inhumane practices have nothing to do with religious devotion, and that the real cause is oil, colonialism, Islamophobia, Orientalism, or Zionism. For those who need data to be convinced, in global surveys of values in which every variable that social scientists like to measure is thrown into the pot, including income, education, and dependence on oil revenues, Islam itself predicts an extra dose of patriarchal and other illiberal values across countries and individuals. Within non-Muslim societies, so does mosque attendance. In Muslim societies, the values are so pervasive that mosque attendance doesn't matter. All these troubling patterns were once true of Christendom. But starting with the Enlightenment, the West initiated a process, still ongoing, of separating the church from the state, carving out a space for secular civil society, and grounding its institutions in a universal humanistic ethics. In most Muslim-majority countries, that process is barely underway. Historians and social scientists, many of them Muslim, have shown how the stranglehold of the Islamic religion over governmental institutions and civil society in Muslim countries has impeded their economic, political, and social progress. Making things worse is a reactionary ideology that became influential through the writings of the Egyptian author Sayyid Qutb, 1906 to 1966, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the inspiration for Al-Qaeda and other Islamist movements. The ideology looks back to the glory days of the Prophet, the first caliphs, and classical Arab civilization, and laments subsequent centuries of humiliation at the hands of crusaders, horse tribes, European colonizers, and most recently, insidious secular modernizers. That history is seen as the bitter fruit of forsaking strict Islamic practice. Redemption can come only from a restoration of true Muslim states governed by Sharia law and purged of non-Muslim influences. Though the role of theistic morality in the problems besetting the Islamic world is inescapable, many Western intellectuals, who would be appalled if the repression, misogyny, homophobia, and political violence that are common in the Islamic world were found in their own societies, even diluted a hundredfold, have become strange apologists when these practices are carried out in the name of Islam. Some of the apologetics, to be sure, come from an admirable desire to prevent prejudice against Muslims. Some are intended to discredit a destructive and possibly self-fulfilling narrative that the world is embroiled in a clash of civilizations. Some fit into a long history of Western intellectuals execrating their own society and romanticizing its enemies, a syndrome we'll return to shortly. But many of the apologetics come from a soft spot for religion among theists, faithists, and second culture intellectuals, and a reluctance to go all in for Enlightenment humanism. Calling out the anti-humanistic features of contemporary Islamic belief is in no way Islamophobic or civilization clashing. The overwhelming majority of victims of Islamic violence and repression are other Muslims. Islam is not a race, and as the ex-Muslim activist Sarah Hader has put it, religions are just ideas and don't have rights. Criticizing the ideas of Islam is no more bigoted than criticizing the ideas of neoliberalism or the Republican Party platform. Can the Islamic world have an enlightenment? Can there be a reform Islam, a liberal Islam, a humanistic Islam, an Islamic ecumenical council? A separation of mosque and state. Many of the faithophilic intellectuals who excuse the illiberalism of Islam also insist that it's unreasonable to expect Muslims to progress beyond it. While the West might enjoy the peace, prosperity, education, and happiness of post-Enlightenment societies, Muslims will never accept this shallow hedonism, and it's only understandable that they should cling to a system of medieval beliefs and customs forever. But this condescension is belied by the history of Islam and by nascent movements within it. Classical Arabic civilization, as I mentioned, was a hothouse of science and secular philosophy. Amartya Sen has documented how the 16th century Mughal Emperor Akbar I implemented a multi-confessional liberal social order, including atheists and agnostics, in Muslim-ruled India at a time when the Inquisition was raging in Europe and Giordano Bruno was burnt at the stake for heresy. Today the forces of modernity are working in many parts of the Islamic world. Tunisia, Bangladesh, Malaysia, and Indonesia have made long strides toward liberal democracy, Chapter 14. In many Islamic countries, attitudes toward women and minorities are improving, Chapter 15, slowly but more detectably among women, the young, and the educated. The emancipative forces that liberalized the West, such as connectivity, education, mobility, and women's advancement, are not bypassing the Islamic world, and the moving sidewalk of generational replacement can outpace the walkers shambling along it. Also, ideas matter. A cadre of Muslim intellectuals, writers, and activists has been pressing the case for a humanistic revolution for Islam. Among them are Suad Adnan, co-founder of the Arab Center for Scientific Research and Humane Studies in Morocco, Mustafa Akyol, author of Islam Without Extremes, Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar, founder of the Global Secular Humanist Movement, Sarah Hader, co-founder of Ex-Muslims of North America, Shadi Hamid, author of Islamic Exceptionalism, Pervez Hoodboy, author of Islam and Science, Religious Orthodoxy and the Battle for Rationality, Leila Hussein, founder of Daughters of Eve, which opposes female genital mutilation, Gulaleh Ismail, founder of Aware Girls in Pakistan, Shiraz Meyer, author of Salafi Jihadism, quoted in the introduction to Part 1, Omar Mahmoud, an American editorialist, Irshad Manji, author of The Trouble with Islam, Maryam Namazi, spokesperson for One Law for All, Amir Ahmad Nasser, author of My Islam, Taslima Nasreen, author of My Girlhood, Majid Nawaz, co-author with Sam Harris of Islam and the Future of Tolerance, Asra Nomani, author of Standing Alone in Mecca, Rahil Raza, author of Their Jihad, Not My Jihad, Ali Rizvi, author of The Atheist Muslim, Wafa Sultan, author of A God Who Hates, Muhammad Sayed, president of Ex-Muslims of North America, and most famously, Salman Rushdie, Ayan Hirsi Ali, and Malala Yousafzai. Obviously, a new Islamic enlightenment will have to be spearheaded by Muslims, but non-Muslims have a role to play. The global network of intellectual influence is seamless, and given the prestige and power of the West, even among those who resent it, Western ideas and values can trickle, flow, and cascade outward in surprising ways. Osama bin Laden, for example, owned a book by Noam Chomsky. The history of moral progress, recounted in books such as The Honor Code by the philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah, suggests that moral clarity in one culture about a regressive practice by another does not always provoke resentful backlash, but can shame the laggards into overdue reform. Past examples include slavery, dueling, foot-binding, and racial segregation. Future ones targeting the United States may include capital punishment and mass incarceration. An intellectual culture that steadfastly defended Enlightenment values and that did not indulge religion when it clashed with humanistic values could serve as a beacon for students, intellectuals, and open-minded people in the rest of the world. After laying out the logic of humanism, I noted that it stood in stark contrast to two other systems of belief. We have just looked at theistic morality. Let me turn to the second enemy of humanism, the ideology behind resurgent authoritarianism, nationalism, populism, reactionary thinking, even fascism. As with theistic morality, the ideology claims intellectual merit, affinity with human nature, and historical inevitability. All three claims, we shall see, are mistaken. Let's begin with some intellectual history. If one wanted to single out a thinker who represented the opposite of humanism, indeed of pretty much every argument in this book, one couldn't do better than the German philologist Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844 to 1900. Earlier in the chapter, I fretted about how humanistic morality could deal with a callous, egoistic, megalomaniacal sociopath. Nietzsche argued that it's good to be a callous, egoistic, megalomaniacal sociopath. Not good for everyone, of course, but that doesn't matter. The lives of the mass of humanity, the botched and the bungled, the chattering dwarves, the flea beetles, count for nothing. What is worthy in life is for a superman, Übermensch, literally overman, to transcend good and evil, exert a will to power, and achieve heroic glory. Only through such heroism can the potential of the species be realized and humankind lifted to a higher plane of being. The feats of greatness may not consist, though, in curing disease, feeding the hungry, or bringing about peace, but rather in artistic masterworks and martial conquest. Western civilization has gone steadily downhill since the heyday of Homeric Greeks, Aryan warriors, helmeted Vikings, and other manly men. It has been especially corrupted by the slave morality of Christianity, the worship of reason by the Enlightenment, and the liberal movements of the 19th century that sought social reform and shared prosperity. Such effete sentimentality led only to decadence and degeneration. Those who have seen the truth should philosophize with a hammer, and give modern civilization the final shove that would bring on the redemptive cataclysm from which a new order would rise. Lest you think I am setting up a straw Übermensch, here are some quotations. I abhor the man's vulgarity when he says, "What is right for one man is right for another. Do not to others that which you would not that they should do unto you." The hypothesis here is ignoble to the last degree. It is taken for granted that there is some sort of equivalence in value between my actions and thine. I do not point to the evil and pain of existence with the finger of reproach, but rather entertain the hope that life may one day become more evil and more full of suffering than it has ever been. Man shall be trained for war and woman for the recreation of the warrior. All else is folly. Thou goest to woman, do not forget thy whip. A declaration of war on the masses by higher men is needed. A doctrine is needed powerful enough to work as a breeding agent, strengthening the strong, paralyzing and destructive for the world-weary. The annihilation of the humbug called morality, the annihilation of the decaying races, dominion over the earth as a means of producing a higher type. That higher party of life, which would take the greatest of all tasks into its hands, the higher breeding of humanity, including the merciless extermination of everything degenerate and parasitical, would make possible again that excess of life on earth, from which the Dionysian state will grow again. These genocidal ravings may sound like they come from a transgressive adolescent who has been listening to too much death metal or a broad parody of a James Bond villain like Dr. Evil in Austin Powers. In fact, Nietzsche is among the most influential thinkers of the 20th century, continuing into the 21st. Most obviously, Nietzsche helped inspire the romantic militarism that led to the First World War, and the fascism that led to the Second. Though Nietzsche himself was neither a German nationalist nor an anti-Semite, it's no coincidence that these quotations leap off the page as quintessential Nazism. Nietzsche posthumously became the Nazis' court philosopher. In his first year as chancellor, Hitler made a pilgrimage to the Nietzsche archive, presided over by Elisabeth Förster Nietzsche, the philosopher's sister and literary executor, who tirelessly encouraged the connection. The link to Italian fascism is even more direct. Benito Mussolini wrote in 1921 that the moment relativism linked up with Nietzsche and with his will to power was when Italian fascism became, as it still is, the most magnificent creation of an individual and a national will to power. The links to Bolshevism and Stalinism, from the Superman to the new Soviet man, are less well known, but amply documented by the historian Bernice Glatzer Rosenthal. The connections between Nietzsche's ideas and the Megadeth movements of the 20th century are obvious enough, a glorification of violence and power, an eagerness to raise the institutions of liberal democracy, a contempt for most of humanity, and a stone-hearted indifference to human life. You'd think this sea of blood would be enough to discredit Nietzsche's ideas among intellectuals and artists, but he is incredibly widely admired. "Nietzsche is Pietsche," says a popular campus graffito and T-shirt. It's not because the man's doctrines are particularly cogent. As Bertrand Russell pointed out in A History of Western Philosophy, they might be stated more simply and honestly in the one sentence, "I wish I had lived in the Athens of Pericles or the Florence of the Medici." The ideas fail the first test of moral coherence, namely generalizability beyond the person offering them. If I could go back in time, I might confront him as follows. "I am a superman, hard, cold, terrible, without feelings and without conscience. As you recommend, I will achieve heroic glory by exterminating some chattering dwarves. Starting with you, Shorty. And I might do a few things to that Nazi sister of yours, too, unless, that is, you can think of a reason why I should not." So if Nietzsche's ideas are repellent and incoherent, why do they have so many fans? Perhaps it is not surprising that an ethic in which the artist, together with the warrior, is uniquely worthy of living should appeal to so many artists. A sample, W. H. Auden, Albert Camus, André Gide, D. H. Lawrence, Jack London, Thomas Mann, Yukio Mishima, Eugene O'Neill, William Butler Yeats, Wyndham Lewis, and, with reservations, George Bernard Shaw, author of Man and Superman. P. G. Woodhouse, in contrast, has Jeeves, a Spinoza fan, say to Bertie Wooster, "You would not enjoy Nietzsche, sir. He is fundamentally unsound." Nietzschean values also appeal to many second-culture literary intellectuals. Recall Leavis sneering at Snow's concern with global poverty and disease because great literature is what men live by, and to social critics who like to snigger at the bourgeoisie, as H. L. Mencken, the American Nietzsche, called the common folk. Though she later tried to conceal it, Ayn Rand's celebration of selfishness, her deification of the heroic capitalist, and her disdain for the general welfare had Nietzsche written all over them. As Mussolini made clear, Nietzsche was an inspiration to relativists everywhere. Disdaining the commitment to truth-seeking among scientists and enlightened thinkers, Nietzsche asserted that there are no facts, only interpretations, and that truth is a kind of error without which a certain species of life could not live. Of course, this left him unable to explain why we should believe that those statements are true. For that and other reasons, he was a key influence on Martin Heidegger, Jean-Paul Sartre, Jacques Derrida, and Michel Foucault, and a godfather to all the intellectual movements of the 20th century that were hostile to science and objectivity, including existentialism, critical theory, post-structuralism, deconstructionism, and postmodernism. Nietzsche, to give him credit, was a lively stylist, and one might excuse the fandom of artists and intellectuals if it consisted of an appreciation of his literary panache and an ironic reading of his portrayal of a mindset that they themselves rejected. Unfortunately, the mindset has sat all too well with all too many of them. A surprising number of 20th century intellectuals and artists have gushed over totalitarian dictators, a syndrome that the intellectual historian Mark Lilla calls tyrannophilia. Some tyrannophiles were Marxists, working on the time-honored principle, "He may be an SOB, but he's our SOB." But many were Nietzschean. The most notorious were Martin Heidegger and the legal philosopher Carl Schmitt, who were gung-ho Nazis and Hitler acolytes. Indeed, no autocrat of the 20th century lacked champions among the clerisy, including Mussolini, Ezra Pound, Shaw, Yeats, Lewis, Lenin, Shaw, H.G. Wells, Stalin, Shaw, Sartre, Beatrice and Sidney Webb, Brecht, W.E.B. Du Bois, Pablo Picasso, Lillian Hellman, Mao, Sartre, Foucault, Du Bois, Louis Althusser, Stephen Rose, Richard Lewontin, the Ayatollah Khomeini, Foucault, and Castro, Sartre, Graham Greene, Gunter Grass, Norman Mailer, Harold Pinter, and, as we saw in Chapter 21, Susan Sontag. At various times, Western intellectuals have also sung the praises of Ho Chi Minh, Muammar Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, Kim Il-sung, Pol Pot, Julius Nyerere, Omar Torrijos, Slobodan Milosevic, and Hugo Chavez. Why should intellectuals and artists of all people kiss up to murderous dictators? One might think that intellectuals would be the first to deconstruct the pretexts of power and artists to expand the scope of human compassion. Thankfully, many have done just that. One explanation offered by the economist Thomas Sowell and the sociologist Paul Hollander is professional narcissism. Intellectuals and artists may feel unappreciated in liberal democracies, which allow their citizens to tend to their own needs in markets and civic organizations. Dictators implement theories from the top down, assigning a role to intellectuals that they feel is commensurate with their worth. But tyrannophilia is also fed by a Nietzschean disdain for the common man, who annoyingly prefers schlock to fine art and culture, and by an admiration of the Superman who transcends the messy compromises of democracy and heroically implements a vision of the good society. Though Nietzsche's romantic heroism glorifies the singular Übermensch rather than any collectivity, is a short step to interpret his single stronger species of man as a tribe, race, or nation. With this substitution, Nietzschean ideals were taken up by Nazism, fascism, and other forms of romantic nationalism, and they star in a political drama that continues to the present day. I used to think that Trumpism was pure id, an upwelling of tribalism and authoritarianism from the dark recesses of the psyche. But madmen in authority distill their frenzy from academic scribblers of a few years back, and the phrase "intellectual roots of Trumpism" is not oxymoronic. Trump was endorsed in the 2016 election by 136 scholars and writers for America in a manifesto called Statement of Unity. Some are connected to the Claremont Institute, a think tank that has been called the academic home of Trumpism. And Trump has been closely advised by two men, Stephen Bannon and Michael Anton, who are reputed to be widely read and who consider themselves serious intellectuals. Anyone who wants to go beyond personality in understanding authoritarian populism must appreciate the two ideologies behind them, both of them militantly opposed to Enlightenment humanism and each influenced in different ways by Nietzsche. One is fascist, the other reactionary. Not in the common left-wing sense of anyone who is more conservative than me, but in their original technical senses. Fascism, from the Italian word for group or bundle, grew out of the romantic notion that the individual is a myth and that people are inextricable from their culture, bloodline, and homeland. The early fascist intellectuals, including Julius Evola, 1898 to 1974, and Charles Maurras, 1868 to 1952, have been rediscovered by neo-Nazi parties in Europe and by Bannon and the alt-right movement in the United States, all of whom acknowledge the influence of Nietzsche. Today's fascism light, which shades into authoritarian populism and romantic nationalism, is sometimes justified by a crude version of evolutionary psychology, in which the unit of selection is the group. Evolution is driven by the survival of the fittest group in competition with other groups, and humans have been selected to sacrifice their interests for the supremacy of their group. This contrasts with mainstream evolutionary psychology, in which the unit of selection is the gene. It follows that no one can be a cosmopolitan, a citizen of the world. To be human is to be a part of a nation. A multicultural, multi-ethnic society can never work because its people will feel rootless and alienated, and its culture will be flattened to the lowest common denominator. For a nation to subordinate its interests to international agreements is to forfeit its birthright to greatness and to become a chump in the global competition of all against all. And since a nation is an organic whole, its greatness can be embodied in the greatness of its leader, who voices the soul of the people directly, unencumbered by the millstone of an administrative state. The reactionary ideology is theoconservatism. Belying the flippant label, coined by the apostate Damon Linker as a play on neoconservatism, the first theocons were 1960s radicals who redirected their revolutionary fervor from the hard left to the hard right. They advocate nothing less than a rethinking of the Enlightenment roots of the American political order. The recognition of a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the mandate of government to secure these rights are, they believe, too tepid for a morally viable society. That impoverished vision has only led to enemy, hedonism, and rampant immorality, including illegitimacy, pornography, failing schools, welfare dependency, and abortion. Society should aim higher than this stunted individualism and promote conformity to more rigorous moral standards from an authority larger than ourselves. The obvious source of these standards is traditional Christianity. Theocons hold that the erosion of the Church's authority during the Enlightenment left Western civilization without a solid moral foundation, and a further undermining during the 1960s left it teetering on the brink. Any day during the Bill Clinton administration, it would plunge into the abyss. No, make that the Obama administration. No, but for sure it would happen during a Hillary Clinton administration. Hence Anton's hysterical essay, The Flight 93 Election, mentioned in Chapter 20, which compared the country to the airliner hijacked on 9/11 and called on voters to charge the cockpit or you die. Whatever discomfort the theocons may have felt from the vulgarity and anti-democratic antics of their 2016 standard-bearer was outweighed by the hope that he alone could impose the radical changes that America needed to stave off catastrophe. Lilla points out an irony in theoconservatism. While it has been inflamed by radical Islamism, which the theocons think will soon start World War III, the movements are similar in their reactionary mindset, with its horror of modernity and progress. Both believe that at some time in the past there was a happy, well-ordered state where a virtuous people knew their place. Then alien secular forces subverted this harmony and brought on decadence and degeneration. Only a heroic vanguard, with memories of the old ways, can restore the society to its golden age. Lest you have lost the trail that connects this intellectual history to current events, bear in mind that in 2017, Trump decided to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord under pressure from Bannon, who convinced him that cooperating with other nations is a sign of surrender in the global contest for greatness. Trump's hostility to immigration and trade grew from the same roots. With the stakes this high, it's good to remind ourselves why the case for neo-theo-reactionary populist nationalism is intellectually bankrupt. I have already discussed the absurdity of seeking a foundation for morality in the institutions that brought us the Crusades, the Inquisition, the witch hunts, and the European wars of religion. The idea that the global order should consist of ethnically homogeneous and mutually antagonistic nation-states is just as ludicrous. First, the claim that humans have an innate imperative to identify with a nation-state, with the implication that cosmopolitanism goes against human nature, is bad evolutionary psychology. Like the supposed innate imperative to belong to a religion, it confuses a vulnerability with a need. People undoubtedly feel solidarity with their tribe, but whatever intuition of tribe we are born with cannot be a nation-state, which is a historical artifact of the 1648 Treaties of Westphalia. Nor could it be a race, since our evolutionary ancestors seldom met a person of another race. In reality, the cognitive category of a tribe, in-group, or coalition is abstract and multidimensional. People see themselves as belonging to many overlapping tribes, their clan, hometown, native country, adopted country, religion, ethnic group, alma mater, fraternity or sorority, political party, employer, service organization, sports team, even brand of camera equipment. If you want to see tribalism at its fiercest, check out a Nikon versus Canon internet discussion group. It's true that political salesmen can market a mythology and iconography that entice people into privileging a religion, ethnicity, or nation as their fundamental identity. With the right package of indoctrination and coercion, they can even turn them into cannon fodder. That does not mean that nationalism is a human drive. Nothing in human nature prevents a person from being a proud Frenchman, European, and citizen of the world all at the same time. The claim that ethnic uniformity leads to cultural excellence is as wrong as an idea can be. There's a reason we refer to unsophisticated things as provincial, parochial, and insular, and to sophisticated ones as urbane and cosmopolitan. No one is brilliant enough to dream up anything of value all by himself. Individuals and cultures of genius are aggregators, appropriators, greatest hit collectors. Vibrant cultures sit in vast catchment areas in which people and innovations flow from far and wide. This explains why Eurasia, rather than Australia, Africa, or the Americas, was the first continent to give birth to expansive civilizations, as documented by Sowell in his Culture Trilogy and Jared Diamond in Guns, Germs, and Steel. It explains why the fountains of culture have always been trading cities on major crossroads and waterways. And it explains why human beings have always been peripatetic, moving to wherever they can make the best lives. Roots are for trees. People have feet. Finally, let's not forget why international institutions and global consciousness arose in the first place. Between 1803 and 1945, the world tried an international order based on nation-states heroically struggling for greatness. It didn't turn out so well. It's particularly wrong-headed for the reactionary right to use frantic warnings about an Islamist war against the West, with a death toll in the hundreds, as a reason to return to an international order in which the West repeatedly fought wars against itself, with death tolls in the tens of millions. After 1945, the world's leaders said, "Well, let's not do that again," and began to downplay nationalism in favor of universal human rights, international laws, and transnational organizations. The result, as we saw in Chapter 11, has been 70 years of peace and prosperity in Europe, and increasingly, the rest of the world. As for the lamentation among editorialists that the Enlightenment is a brief interlude, that epitaph is likelier to mark the resting place of neo-fascism, neo-reaction, and related backlashes of the early 21st century. The European elections and self-destructive flailing of the Trump administration in 2017 suggest that the world may have reached peak populism, and as we saw in Chapter 20, the movement is on a demographic road to nowhere. Headlines notwithstanding, the numbers show that democracy, Chapter 14, and liberal values, Chapter 15, are riding a long-term escalator that is unlikely to go into reverse overnight. The advantages of cosmopolitanism and international cooperation cannot be denied for long in a world in which the flow of people and ideas is unstoppable. Though the moral and intellectual case for humanism is, I believe, overwhelming, some might wonder whether it is any match for religion, nationalism, and romantic heroism in the campaign for people's hearts. Will the Enlightenment ultimately fail because it cannot speak to primal human needs? Should humanists hold revival meetings, at which preachers thump Spinoza's ethics on the pulpit, and ecstatic congregants roll back their eyes and babble in Esperanto? Should they stage rallies at which young men in colored shirts salute giant posters of John Stuart Mill? I think not. Recall that a vulnerability is not the same as a need. The citizens of Denmark, New Zealand, and other happy parts of the world get by perfectly well without these paroxysms. The bounty of a cosmopolitan secular democracy is there for everyone to see. Still, the appeal of regressive ideas is perennial, and the case for reason, science, humanism, and progress always has to be made. When we fail to acknowledge our hard-won progress, we may come to believe that perfect order and universal prosperity are the natural state of affairs, and that every problem is an outrage that calls for blaming evildoers, wrecking institutions, and empowering a leader who will restore the country to its rightful greatness. I have made my own best case for progress and the ideals that made it possible, and have dropped hints on how journalists, intellectuals, and other thoughtful people, including the listeners to this audiobook, might avoid contributing to the widespread heedlessness of the gifts of the Enlightenment. Remember your math. An anecdote is not a trend. Remember your history. The fact that something is bad today doesn't mean it was better in the past. Remember your philosophy. One cannot reason that there's no such thing as reason, or that something is true or good because God said it is. And remember your psychology. Much of what we know isn't so, especially when our comrades know it too. Keep some perspective. Not every problem is a crisis, plague, epidemic, or existential threat, and not every change is the end of this, the death of that, or the dawn of a post-something era. Don't confuse pessimism with profundity. Problems are inevitable, but problems are solvable, and diagnosing every setback as a symptom of a sick society is a cheap grab for gravitas. Finally, drop the Nietzsche. His ideas may seem edgy, authentic, bad, while humanism seems sappy, unhip, uncool. But what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? The case for enlightenment now is not just a matter of debunking fallacies or disseminating data. It may be cast as a stirring narrative, and I hope that people with more artistic flair and rhetorical power than I can tell it better and spread it farther. The story of human progress is truly heroic. It is glorious. It is uplifting. It is even, I dare say, spiritual. It goes something like this. We are born into a pitiless universe, facing steep odds against life-enabling order and in constant jeopardy of falling apart. We were shaped by a force that is ruthlessly competitive. We are made from crooked timber, vulnerable to illusions, self-centeredness, and at times astounding stupidity. Yet human nature has also been blessed with resources that open a space for a kind of redemption. We are endowed with the power to combine ideas recursively, to have thoughts about our thoughts. We have an instinct for language, allowing us to share the fruits of our experience and ingenuity. We are deepened with the capacity for sympathy, for pity, imagination, compassion, commiseration. These endowments have found ways to magnify their own power. The scope of language has been augmented by the written, printed, and electronic word. Our circle of sympathy has been expanded by history, journalism, and the narrative arts. And our puny, rational faculties have been multiplied by the norms and institutions of reason, intellectual curiosity, open debate, skepticism of authority and dogma, and the burden of proof to verify ideas by confronting them against reality. As the spiral of recursive improvement gathers momentum, we eke out victories against the forces that grind us down, not least the darker parts of our own nature. We penetrate the mysteries of the cosmos, including life and mind. We live longer, suffer less, learn more, get smarter, and enjoy more small pleasures and rich experiences. Fewer of us are killed, assaulted, enslaved, oppressed, or exploited by the others. From a few oases, the territories with peace and prosperity are growing, and could someday encompass the globe. Much suffering remains, and tremendous peril, but ideas on how to reduce them have been voiced, and an infinite number of others are yet to be conceived. We will never have a perfect world, and it would be dangerous to seek one. But there is no limit to the betterments we can attain if we continue to apply knowledge to enhance human flourishing. This heroic story is not just another myth. Myths are fictions, but this one is true. True to the best of our knowledge, which is the only truth we can have. We believe it because we have reasons to believe it. As we learn more, we can show which parts of the story continue to be true and which ones false, as any of them might be, and any could become. And the story belongs not to any tribe, but to all of humanity, to any sentient creature with the power of reason and the urge to persist in its being. For it requires only the convictions that life is better than death, health is better than sickness, abundance is better than want, freedom is better than coercion, happiness is better than suffering, and knowledge is better than superstition and ignorance. This is Arthur Mori. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress by Steven Pinker. This program was directed by Jessica Kay. Executive producer, Juliana Wilson. Text copyright 2018 by Steven Pinker. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.